Somewhere out there in the vast nothingness of space. Somewhere far away in space and time. Staring upward at the gleaming stars in the obsidian sky. We're marooned on a small island in an endless sea. Confined to a tiny spit of sand, unable to escape. But tonight, on this small planet, on Earth, we're going to rock civilization.
Hi, I'm Ian Wishart. This is live365.com and the Ian Wishart Show. And we're also simulcasting with Vinny Eastwood from the Vinny Eastwood Show. Vinny, good evening again.
Good evening again.
Yes.
Does the evening get any better if you say that it's good twice?
Probably gets twice as good.
You never know. We'll hypothesize on that. All right.
Yeah, what I was going to do is going to share with your listeners a little bit about Totalitaria. In terms of some of the juicier bits, one of the things I discovered in that book was that, did you know, for example, about the meditation room in the UN?
I heard, no, I didn't really hear anything about it because apparently it's a silent meditation room.
Very good answer. I'm sure most of your listeners will be unaware. The United Nations claims to be a secular organization. And you would think so. It's a parliament of the world, right? However, there's a twist. The United Nations, when it was set up for spiritual reasons as much as natural reasons, because they saw in 1944-45 the only way of preventing world horrors like World War II was to unite mankind under one flag. And the only way to do that was to create a new spirituality, a new world religion. So that was part of the driving force behind the establishment of the United Nations in 1945, and that's available on the UN website, that claim. The second Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, was a Swedish guy in the 1950s. He lasted about 10 years in the job before he died in a plane crash in the Congo. But one of his key acts was to establish what he called a meditation room directly under the UN debating chamber. Now, most people are totally unaware of this and what it is. He brought in the world's largest piece of iron ore, what's officially known as magnetite. The largest piece of iron ore ever mined. It was 6.5 tons. He had it specially cut in the form of an iron ore altar. Of all things, an altar. 5 feet high, 2 feet wide, 6 feet long, bit like a coffin. Except a big, you know, imagine the stone table in the Narnia film Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and you get the impression. And he built this room directly under the UN debating chamber in the shape of a truncated pyramid to a very particular occult plan, according again to a document available through one of the UN NGOs. And it was all very specially constructed. In fact, he would make visits at 2 o'clock in the morning during construction. It took a year and a half to construct, to make sure that the lighting was exactly the way it should be at that precise time of the night. And the whole thing was done very, very specially. He gave custody of the UN meditation room across to a crowd called the Lucis Trust. And people can Google that if they want. But I detail all this in the book. The Lucis Trust were affiliated with what was known once as the Lucifer Publishing Company. And the name should be a clue to people, Lucifer. It was set up by Alice Bailey, who was one of the disciples of Theosophy and Helena Blavatsky. And it was this secret society that hatched the plan to take over the world. Or, in fact, they're the ones who managed to effectively carry it through. Bailey and Blavatsky's disciples included Dag Hammarskjöld. They also included the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, Dr. Robert Mueller. Mueller was one of those who set up UNESCO. He was instrumental in setting up the World Environment, the UN Environment Program, and a range of other big programs. But he too was a follower of Theosophy and the Lucifer Publishing Company. The altar in the United Nations building, to cut a long story short, is dedicated to Lucifer. And for those who don't know, Lucifer is Satan. Of all the things you'd expect to find in the United Nations, an altar to Satan is not one of them. But there it is. Smack bang, there's a photograph in the book. There are photographs online of the UN meditation room if you want to take a look at it. Why would there be such a thing in the UN building? Then when you read the writings of these guys at the heads of the UN and you see their agenda for the planet and what they wanted to roll out, it makes the prickles on the back of your neck stand up. It really does. And as I said, you know, it doesn't matter whether you believe in this stuff. It matters that they believe in this stuff. Now, you'd think that perhaps this might have died out with the guy who died in the plane crash, but sadly, no. The next Secretary General of the United Nations, his successor, a guy named Hugh Thont, was also mysteriously a follower of Alice Bailey. And again, a key player in this altar to Lucifer in the United Nations. And he was instrumental in inviting across Pope Paul VI to become the first Roman Catholic Pope to ever address the United Nations. The day was October 4, 1965. The news articles about that are available online in newspaper archives. You have to pay for access to them, but they're there. And we've quoted and photographed some of them in the book. Pope Paul VI went downstairs underneath the General Assembly building with Hugh Thont, and he prayed at the altar to Lucifer. The head of the Roman Catholic Church prayed at an altar to Satan. He then, in his General Assembly speech, pledged the Roman Catholic Church's loyalty to the United Nations and everything it stood for. He then gave Hugh Thont his papal rings and symbols of authority as a gesture of goodwill. The symbolism of that is stark. Did the church, the Roman Catholic Church, on October 4, 1965, do a deal with the devil? Spooky stuff. Read the book. It's interesting, though, because are you aware of Father Malachi Martin?
Nope.
Never heard of him?
No.
He's written books like The Keys to This Blood. He's a best-selling, or was a best-selling author. He died in very controversial circumstances about 10 years ago in the US. He was pushed. Never recovered from falling downstairs, and his manuscript for his final book went missing. But he was a Vatican insider. He was an advisor to one of the popes, and he published details of what he alleged was a black mass, a satanic mass in the Vatican, around the time that Pope Paul VI was enthroned. Now, Malachi Martin wasn't aware of the UN Meditation Room and its significance, and he wasn't aware, I don't think, of what happened when Paul VI went and prayed there. But it all fits with what Malachi Martin later wrote and what another cardinal came out with in 1996 and said that there were still satanic masses taking place inside the Catholic Church. Now, again, it doesn't matter whether you listening believe in this sort of stuff or not. What matters is that the people doing it believe. And so you have the United Nations. Its only religious symbol in the entire building is an altar dedicated to Lucifer. Ask yourself the significance of that. Read the book if you want the full details. I mean, we could have a debate about that for years to come, but I've laid it out. The documents are all there. It's fascinating stuff. I sit there scratching my head, and I've asked the question in the book. If anybody can give me a rational explanation as to how this sort of stuff happens, I'm hoping to hear it. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? You know,
I don't think we'll ever get one.
You ever wonder, one day if you woke up and it turns out that actually we were crazy? Like, everybody else was right. Everybody else was right the whole time. We were totally wrong. Like oh, right, thank goodness. Good. There isn't a bunch of ruthless criminals, satanic, sociopathic, child molesting, human trafficking, murdering, psychopathic, pedophile scum running the entire world. That's a great weight off my mind.
Wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be great? But you couldn't make this stuff up. But get this. Another thing that's in the book as well. The United Nations has its World Heritage Sites. You're familiar with those? UNESCO does them. They, you know, New Zealand's got a couple of ones listed in the World Heritage Site, right?
Yeah, there's one on Waiheke Island. I think the whole of Waiheke is a World Heritage Site or something.
It is the Waiheke Island, it is. But one of the sites that they've chosen for the United Nations World Heritage Sites is a place called Lumbini. And Lumbini is the reputed birthplace of Buddha. Except the United Nations calls him Lord Buddha. But they don't have that. There are some thousand or more documents in the UNESCO files with the title Lord Buddha. But just for sake of balance, I was just curious to check it out. Now, you'll know what I'm about to say. I did a Google search in the United Nations files for anything saying Lord Jesus and found nothing. There's not a single document. But anyway, the twist to the story is that Lumbini has a reference number. It has an assigned number in the United Nations system. Would you care to guess what that number is?
It's 666 or 33.
You got it in one. 666. Yeah, you couldn't make this stuff up. You really couldn't. And it's fascinating because it ties into the whole Helena Blavatsky thing, because one of the things she did, and this will be I'm sure you'll have some of the Buddhists listening to you spitting tacks right now. But again, I can't apologize for the truth, but here it is. Helena Blavatsky heard from some spirit guides in 1875, who said to her, the coming one, the absolute supreme, is returning to Earth, and you need to go and spread the news and prepare the way. And the spirits told her to go to Sri Lanka, or what was then known as Ceylon, which was the last remaining stronghold of Buddhism in the world. Buddhism had been wiped out on the Indian mainland and in most of the Asian continent by the various governments that had been in power, and the Muslims in particular didn't like it. So Buddhism was very, very much on its last legs. It was an almost extinct religion outside of Ceylon. There are a few isolated pockets in Japan, but not much. Blavatsky went across to Ceylon with her co-founder of Theosophy, and they rewrote Buddhism, and they incorporated a whole lot of new occult, Western occult ideas into Buddhism. And they very much pitched it as one of enlightenment and various levels of enlightenment and initiation and so on. And they then sent their disciples out from the Buddhist monasteries in Ceylon to the rest of Asia and take it to Thailand and Burma and Japan and China and so forth and India and reacquaint the world with Buddhism. If you actually look, and I did this in the book, and I've cited the scholarly studies, there are academic scholars who've studied the history of Buddhism, and they're very clear and matter of fact in their announcement. They say that modern Buddhism as you know it is not authentic. The Buddhism that you strike in New Zealand or the United States or Asia or Thailand or Burma or wherever is not authentic original Buddhism. It is based entirely on the Blavatsky Satanistic Luciferian plot. And they've made that point in the academic study groups and reports. So you have this group, and they've not only infiltrated the United Nations, they've infiltrated various world religions, Catholicism and Protestant evangelical churches and Buddhism. They've got control of virtually every belief system in the world. It's staggering stuff.
Mm. It's like diet Buddhism, or I can't believe it's not Buddhism.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those... It's one of those stories that, it's the Matrix. It takes you down the rabbit hole and says, well, what do you want to find out? And that's why I think it's shaking people up. But it's important, because if we don't face up to these truths and get to grips with where it's come from, you know, we will never have the answers to it. It's only those people who are truly informed who can make informed decisions. That's my view of the world.
Well, I think that's actually pretty straightforward. Like, only people with legs can walk. And
true, only fish with wings can fly.
Yeah, and the other element that we need to actually look into here is also the corruption of virtually everything that it is to be human. I mean, what have we got? We've got those three aspects. There's the physical, the mental, and the spiritual. And I think the New World Order has been so adept at having physical influences mental influences and spiritual influences circling around everybody at all the time. If even one of those hooks gets you, if one of the physical influences, like be they perhaps a thimerosal mercury in the vaccines or something like that, causes autism, boom, they've got you. Or if there is a false religion, like the New Age religion, boom, they've got you. Or if there is a logical fallacy kind of thing, like believing in mainstream politics to a large degree and thinking that those politicians are actually the rulers of your country, they've got you. Mm. It comes to the point where it's actually a miracle. One might even say divine providence that we've woken up to this fact at all.
Yeah, it is. But it brings with it its own baggage because you know the people involved in this have put a lot of planning and effort into their plan to control the world, and they've come very close to it. I mean, you look at the New Zealand NCEA education exams, right? Most people won't be aware that our NCEA education exams are based on the World Core Curriculum of the United Nations. The World Core Curriculum of the United Nations was written by Robert Mueller, the aforementioned follower of Helena Blavatsky and her satanistic beliefs. And he was firmly wedded to these and the belief that they needed to capture kids in the education system to prepare them for the New World Order. So our exam system is based on the education policies of these mad fruit bats. And that, I think, is something that you know people should focus on. Your kids are being trained and indoctrinated and taught. And you possibly, if you're listening and you're young enough, have been trained and taught to think in this way. And to you, it seems absolutely normal. But if you know who the people are who are pulling your strings and rattling your chain, you're better placed to wake up and start, you know, readjusting your thinking. But if you're never warned about this, you'll never get that chance.
It is said that a person needs to hear the same thing 7 times. By 7 different people. You can't sell the same person the same thing 7 times and have them get it. It has to be 7 different people saying the same thing. And I think this is why people in this truth movement, as it's been called, are experiencing a lot of frustration and pain as a result of going out and attempting to quote-unquote wake people up, is because they think that they can do it alone. And they get remarkably disappointed and mistakenly give up entirely on waking people up and hold a pin on their fellow man and think, oh, nobody can be saved. There's no gonna... Look, it ain't all your responsibility. All you got to do is play your part and hope that 6 other people play theirs. That's all it is. Don't put the whole world on your shoulders.
It is about passing it forward and hoping that things go viral. I mean, one of the issues with our book is that people were ringing up and buying 10 copies at a time because as so many people spoke to me on the phone, they said, look, all this is in paper that I've been concerned about for years. I've suspected, you know, the conspiracy websites, they make these sort of claims, but they don't really provide any hard evidence. And you've gone and nailed it back down to the original source documents. We love you for it. I'll take 10 copies, please. And each one of those people is paying it forward. They're effectively giving the gift of knowledge, if you like, to their mates and their family and friends and so forth. And the idea goes viral. So you're right. Those people are having other people come to them and dump books on them. I saw a book review in Australia, totally unexpected. Somebody had gone and bought the reviewer a copy of Totalitaria in Perth and dumped it on them. And the reviewer ended up giving the book 6 stars out of a possible 5, which I was grateful for, as you would be as a struggling author. But this is the point. Until people read it and hear it and understand it, the context isn't there. And you know, even this radio show or my own radio show, we can't really cover in a radio broadcast the nuances and the evidence that people need to really get their heads around some of this stuff. And a lot of the stuff you do and I do, because it's too complex. All we can do is draw attention to it and say, look, the information's out there. But people at the end of the day have to get off their backsides and read it. Because only when they've seen the evidence for themselves with their own eyes will they believe.
Now, there's a number of different media apparatus that are being used. Now, I'm sure you realize as well as I do, Ian, that one of the best methodologies of brainwashing is to infiltrate the media, right? You know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how anybody could...
I'm not sure brainwashing is the right word, though. There'd have to be brains in place in the first place to do it.
Well, granted. But the... But the point here is, it's about, I think actually what I had to realize about what my chosen career is now, I guess it's kind of not much of a choice, rather a lack of options, is I'm a counter-propaganda warfare agent, more or less. Would you see yourself in such a way, to a degree, considering who your enemy is? Ignorance, you know?
I get accused of being a counter propaganda warfare agent. Look, you know, we both, all of us have a role to play. And at the end of the day, we can't, as I said earlier, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. All we can do is offer the evidence and say, look, this needs further investigation, or here is the evidence. It's absolutely clear. One of the things with me in my brand of journalism is I'm not afraid to stand up and fly against the current if that's where the evidence is taking me, even though it might make me seriously unpopular. Look, I'm as aware as the next person. It'd be far easier for me to take the easy road and to give people what they want and expect to hear. I'd be a rich man if I did that. But I couldn't live with myself. And that's the truth of it. You know, as I said in the Kahui case, it would have been so easy for me to interview Maxina King and then do a hatchet job on her and paint her in the worst possible light and give the public, the baying public for blood, what they wanted. I would have sold 50,000 copies of that book if I'd done that. But I couldn't live with myself for doing that because it wasn't right. It wasn't the truth. All we can do is try and battle the propaganda, as you so correctly put it.
Well,
unceasingly.
Yeah. It's kind of like a protracted war, and these secret societies that you have exposed in your book in Totalitaria Ad Nauseam, one in particular that I'd like to discuss is the Fabian Socialists. These are some very, very dangerous ideologies that are coming up, and I know that we're coming to the end of the show in about less than 10 minutes, aren't we, Ian?
Close to it.
Okay. Well, for those who are unaware of what Fabian Socialism is, there's two symbols that I've seen, sigils, if you will, that symbolize Fabian Socialism that they've actually adopted for themselves. The first being a tortoise with a hammer. The philosophy behind that meaning they very, very, very slowly move towards you, and just when they're right next to you, wham, they get you with the hammer. The other symbol for Fabian Socialism is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Now, Fabian Socialism in New Zealand, I've looked up this, and you should see all the left-wing journalists and bloggers and things of this nature who like them on Facebook.
Yeah, you know? It is shocking. And it is I talk in Totalitaria about what I call a convergence of opportunities. And what I mean by that is that the principle of globalization is welcomed by different groups for different reasons. They share a common cause. And we're at this perfect storm moment in history whereby you have politicians who believe in globalization for political power, predominantly those of the left, but sometimes those of the right. There are business corporations and global corporations who believe in globalization for the sake of market efficiencies and making maximum profits by conducting their affairs in countries with the cheapest labor and the lowest regulations. There are lobby groups and charities who believe in globalization and world government because they stand to gain contracts out of that, and they see it as politically acceptable for them and the missions that they're trying to accomplish. And you just look at the climate change bandwagon and the lobby groups and charities that are involved in that, making billions off it. And then there are spiritual globalists, and they are the people we've talked about in Totalitaria as well, the Helena Blavatskys and the theosophists of this world, who believe they are ushering in world government to bring in the coming one, in short, Satan. They call him Satan. And they have spiritual reasons for globalization, but nonetheless, they all share a common cause. And so these groups join together loosely in various forms and work towards this common cause, and they adopt various aspects of their belief systems as they need to in order to move forward together on various things. And so you get this tie-in between big business and New Age evangelization and environmental causes. There's a massive tie-up. And you, if you look, if people want to know what this is like, go and look at the money earned by Greenpeace worldwide and Oxfam and Worldwide Fund for Nature and so forth off donations since Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth. They have made billions in donations by scaring the public about climate change. There is money to be mined in these mines, and they are doing it left, right, and center. It's extremely cynical. I mean, the reason Greenpeace does some of the things that it does, I mean, put this on the record, I was a Greenpeace donor for years, for about a decade, after the Rainbow Warrior bombing. But I eventually became wary of the politicization and the propaganda that was taking place, because I was working in TV3 and we would be fed these Greenpeace videos that they'd taken themselves from Lord knows where. And they were regularly feeding material into the news networks and effectively manipulating the news coverage of various events. Good on them for doing it. It's just propaganda 101. But I suddenly realized that they were tying all these campaigns into the media releases into their donation campaigns. They'd start running TV ads calling for donations on the back of them. And I realized that these charities are making massive amounts of money, and it's non-taxable, or was non-taxable, because of their charitable status at the time. So everybody in this world is making money one way, shape, or form. It's just that a lot of them are saying, we're doing it for altruistic reasons, and they're hoodwinking the public. So I think it's, you know, incumbent on all of us to sort of look at the motivations and so forth, and this convergence of opportunities explains why the Fabian Socialists, you know, there's a group called Socialist International, and Helen Clark is a senior figure in that group. Mm-hmm. And they have a clear pathway to world government. They're an advisor to the United Nations. They've written an exploratory paper for the UN on achieving global governance and what has to happen to do that within the next 10 years. Now, their plan dovetails with the Theosophy plan as well. But Theosophy is providing the ideological, spiritual aspect of it, and the control of the public through education and belief systems. Socialists are providing the framework and the governance mechanism, the politicization of it. So all of these different groups are working in concert, and that's what I'm trying to explore in the book. I mean, the book is not just about, you know, devil worshipping nutcases and fruit bats. It's also about the Edward Snowden issue, the surveillance that's going on. And the point that I make there is that people may have, in the mainstream public, no problem with surveillance on Islamic terrorism. But the problem is this. If we agree to the level of surveillance that's going on in our private lives on the premise of combating terrorism, that infrastructure will stay in place forever. And when it comes to the new regime, they'll suddenly have infrastructure in their hands that is capable of quelling dissent very rapidly. And so those same people who welcome it today for a narrow purpose won't be so happy with it in 10 years' time when it's used against them.
Yep. It's the old adage. What was that? The guy who was quoting, you know, first they came for the Jews, but I didn't stand up because I wasn't Jewish, and so on and so forth. And I think these people have figured out quite a brilliant plan. I mean, you got to hand it to them, Ian. They've well thought it out. They've well planned. However, what I've found about the lesson of history is even the best formed plans that have been protracted over many, many long periods of time can be messed up in very, very short periods of time significantly by individuals. Like, you know, it's actually pretty straightforward. Part of the great thing about being human is that we're endowed with immense quantities of power. I'm not talking about like, oh, it's just a little bit of power, you know, only a few people can do a few things or whatever. I'm talking about unfathomable, like you don't have any idea how much courage you have until it takes X amount of courage to survive what you're going through. You don't know how strong you are until your strength has been tested. And I think what has happened to society is that we've been wrapped in bubble wrap for so long that we think we still need it, both for our minds and our bodies. We don't.
Yeah, well, this is the whole nanny state argument that you go back 100 years when nanny state didn't exist and you had to survive on your own, people were tougher, much tougher than they are now. Today, we expect the government, the state, to do everything for us. Cradle to the grave almost. And we whine and we whinge and we complain when the state doesn't provide the various services we think we're entitled to. the risk of that, I mean, sure, we can go providing entitlements to everybody till the cows come home, but the risk of that is that we effectively dumb ourselves down. Not only that, we enter into a contract with the state where we sell our souls. And that's what's happening. But the state feels it can have more and more and more and more control of your life because it's paying more and more and more money to look after you. And that's the paradigm. That's the contradiction that we have to face.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think, what was it? My two favorite pieces of advice I was given by Jack Blood, his American talk radio show host, has been talking about this kind of stuff that we've been talking about for like 15 years. And when you're going into it, you will often find out that it's quite difficult and the road is long and hard and you've got to maintain some sort of a sense of balance. So I asked him how you did that. How did you do this for 15 years and still maintain on an even keel and not turn into some form of douchebag? He says, number one, drink. If I didn't drink, I would have gone frickin' nuts. Number two, take the money. If you're not doing anything, if you're not doing anything evil, if you're actually doing the right thing and people offer you money and they're not asking you to compromise what it is that you're doing, just take the money.
Exactly. Well, if people want to support me, they're welcome to. I'll take as much money as they can give. Seriously, though, they can get the books that I've talked about at Amazon.com or IanWishart.com. It's easy enough. And ebooks, they're available instantly. So I really urge people to read the material that's there, particularly in Totalitaria, because it's an eye-opening thing. It's getting great reviews across America and Australia. The reason I've done the book is primarily to wake people up and to give them the evidence that they need to say, here comes the New World Order. This is what we need to be watching out for. It's not happening by accident. It's happening by design. And if you realize what the plan is and how it may affect your life, then you'd be much better placed to try and sidestep it.
Mm. Did you think about turning it into an audio book? Because as soon as I started reading it, I was like, man, I would love to read this out as an audio book.
It's funny, you know, I gave a speech last night and people made the comment after I gave my presentation, you know, the book really came alive. It'd make a fantastic movie, but no one would believe it. it's just staggering. But it's, you know, if you've read it, the book is based on fact. It's all there. It's all nailed down. It comes down to whether you believe these people have the abilities that they claim they have, but nonetheless, they're in positions of power. They're running the United Nations. And the United Nations came very, very close in 2009 to imposing a global government through the climate change debate at Copenhagen, the treaty there. They missed out because they were sprung about 2 weeks beforehand, and the American media publicized the plan for a world government clause in the Copenhagen Treaty, and it got ditched. But the UN is coming back for another bite in 2015, next year. They're gearing up for what they call a major planetary announcement on sustainability goals that will impose a governance structure to achieve sustainability. And you know what? The one thing I found out from Totalitaria and researching and writing it is that I once believed that nobody would fall for the New World Order because they'd know what it represented and all of the drama associated with it. What I found since writing the book is that the public, a large amount of the public, are begging for the New World Order to come. They genuinely are begging for it, and they don't understand what they're begging for, but they've been conditioned to believe it so much they're like sheep bleating in the distance in the paddocks for mummy. And these are the people I'm trying to reach.
You know what this reminds me of? A film called, what was it, Captain America, The First Avenger. and he was talking about Red Skull. He wanted to, like, bomb, all of his enemies. And he was like, his enemies, not Germany's enemies, his enemies. And he could bomb pretty much everything. And the American captain was going, don't you think that that's a really crazy plan, though? Because you'll destroy the whole world. And his assistant goes, the consequence of the plan is of no consequence. He goes, why? Because he can do it.
yeah, it's the way it is.
Yeah, you know, it's a shame, but hey, look at it this way. At least, even if I were to die tomorrow, be exterminated by jackboot thug or whatever, I'd be like, at least I didn't sit around and do absolutely nothing. What's everybody else's excuse? Come on, it feels good to expose scumbaggery. Expose it, I say.
Exactly. This is Ian Wishart, live365.com, and Vinny Eastwood on the Vinny Eastwood Show. Vinny, it's been great talking to you today. And thanks for your company, and we'll be replaying this live on the Ian Wishart Show on live365.com through the week as well.
Fantastic. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. And also bear in mind, the Vinnie Eastwood Show is a listener-supported broadcast. If you would like to go and support me and the work that I do, getting out all of these voices that the mainstream media will either censor entirely or not give enough time to explain their ideas in full, go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And make a donation today, or a regular donation, preferably into the Kiwi Bank, because PayPal always takes a percentage, and we all know how much I don't like giving the New World Order a percentage. Thank you very much. We'll see you again sometime, folks.
You are the only exception. You are the only exception.